Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, and welcome to a brand new year. Speaking of which, today we're asking what we'll be reading, watching and listening to in 2017. It's a straightforward enough question, possibly, but there's a lot of stuff to get through, so we've hired in a few people to do the hard work for us, because we're nice like that. Joining me in the studio today for our cultural roundup are the broadcaster and DJ Georgie Rogers, film critic Jason Solomons and the writer Mark Mason. Pull up a chair and bring the new year in with our definitive guide to 2017. It says on the script, on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Georgie, Jason and Mark, Happy New Year to you all.
And
thank
you.
The eagle-eared amongst you might realise it's a very similar lineup to a programme we did last year, rounding up the best of 2016. It was such a success that we've got you all back around the table. Thank you very much. Thank you for presumably just writing down what you were going to be looking forward to all through Christmas lunch and beyond to come into the studio armed and ready. And we're going to start with books and we're going to start with music, I should say. What's wrong with you? You can't do anything. You can't even look at your piece of paper in front of you, man.
Too much turkey.
2017's got off to a great start.
I know, it's got off a really wobbly. There's three wheels on my wagon, my 2017 wagon. Rather than precursor the whole show, let's just start. Let's go straight in with Georgie Rogers and her tips for music in 2017. First up, you've got for us Laura Marling. Georgie, take it away with Laura.
Oh, my hopeless wanderer. You can't come in, you don't live here anymore. Oh, some creepy conjurer who died.
Okay, a little bite of soothing new from Laura Marling, something fresh for 2017 as picked by Georgie Rogers. Georgie.
So this is her sixth album, largely written on the road off the back of the last album. And I thought it would be nice to hear it just because you can hear it's a slinky little number.
It's something jazzy in there,
bass.
Yeah.
You don't hear a quadruple bass track very often.
Yeah. Really slinky. I think maybe her sexiest track yet. She's been speaking about this new album and it's sort of like a new observed take on womanhood. She was having quite a masculine time in her life, and this one she started writing this album as if a man was writing about a woman, and then she kind of thought, actually, it's not a man, it's me. And so she's looking at femininity and sort of feels like she doesn't need to pretend that it's a man to justify the intimacy or the way that she's viewing a woman. So she's come to it with this first taster track, Soothing, which does what it says on the tin. It's very soothing. And she's directed the video as well for the first time, so that's a new thing.
And the promo is very
for
interesting for this. That's super sexy, kind of quite a departure from her as well.
Yeah.
Considering she was a folk star back in the day, and now she's becoming very slinky.
Yeah, and there's sort of like, in the video, there's two women wearing PVC suits, which sort of really accentuates their form, sort of entwined, and then there's people, like a sort of like a crowd of people just watching it. And that was apparently inspired by a bunch of vivid dreams that she had while she was making the album. She's quite prolific. She's one of my favourite lyricists, and she's consistently provided really brilliant music. There was a time when she sort of went a little bit American sounding, which I don't know, I wasn't sure about for
but
a
bit. She's done a lot of touring as well. I suppose a lot of that rubs off. Who knows what her label tells her and what her management tells her, and if you want to fill out this bowl in this state, then maybe you need to, sound a bit more twanging than West Country.
After I Speak Because I Can, which I think was my favourite album from her, it just went a bit more, there was kind of, you could hear a bit more of a voice, whether she was putting it on, I don't know, but
is there a danger when she does it? Because I couldn't, from there, I wasn't sure that was Laura Marling. Sometimes, actresses do this sometimes as well. They're so protean. Andrea Riseborough does it, Ruth Wilson. They're so different role to role that sometimes you're not actually sure it's them. A good thing, technically, but if you're a fan of Laura Marling, is it obvious that this Laura Marling, or she'd undergone such a change that, and that she's obviously very gifted in doing so, but sometimes you risk kind of not losing your core audience, but, I don't know, you might get some new ones, but you might also kind of, people kind of go, I didn't know Laura Marling did that at all, because I'm like, this sounds great. I didn't know Laura Marling sounded like that.
Yeah, it definitely sounds different. I think sonically it sounds different. Vocally, I feel like she's speaking more kind of directly and more it's intimate, and there is a sense of that intimacy, it comes through. But definitely,
Joni Mitchell,
sonically it sounds a bit different.
She went jazz.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sort of stalks you, this track. And then at the end, it just there's this beautiful resolution where it's just suddenly it's sort of quite classic. So I'm really excited.
There's a lot happening. There's a lot to listen to in that. There's a lot of detail on it. There's a lot of really good musicianship on it, and it's unashamedly sexy. It's welcome back, Laura Marling, I think we're
definitely
saying. Yeah. Who knew it was you? Jason Solomon says, looking over his glasses. Laura,
welcome back. Welcome back. Who's that?
Okay, let's move on to your second choice, Georgie. The Big Moon. The record is going to be called Love in the Fourth Dimension. Should we have a clip of this? Should we do it that way around? Okay, that is Cupid from Love in the Fourth Dimension, which is out in April, courtesy of Big Moon. Someone's been listening to some Supergrass.
Honestly, is the electric guitar ever going to die out?
Isn't it? For literally
decades now, they've been predicting the end of electric guitars. No, and they're not going to die out, are they?
No, and here is four girls, great at playing their instruments. Yeah. It's a female band to get excited about. And I think people are getting excited about them. And they've had a really organic rise. I hate the word organic, but they have, you know, they've really steadily built it over the last 18 months or so with really strong singles, an EP, the Cupid EP, which is a great EP, a nice Madonna cover of Beautiful Stranger, their punchiest track to date, Cupid, which you just heard. I think it's exciting that, you know, they've been taken on by Fiction Records, which has been home to career artists, you know, the Maccabees, people that are allowed to kind of develop. So they're Tame Impala, Kate Tempest, people have got their own thing, but they'll kind of give them the time and maybe the push to just kind of do it at their own pace. And
that's an interesting thing, just quickly on the record label, how important is that? I remember talking before Christmas about, you know, this idea of publishers and people pushing you in different ways, you know, and I wonder how important the label still is, you know, in defining an artist and giving them time to grow and mature and stuff.
Yeah, I think it's important because it's money. It's how it enables them to actually to do it. But it's about having the right label, and Fiction, clearly with these guys, they've let them keep what sets them apart from everyone else. And that's like, you know, imaginative music. It's really catchy. It's kind of thrilling, grungy guitars. It's loud, tight harmonies. Juliet's voice is expressive, but it's not overcooked. They can take the out of themselves. It's quite nonchalant. You can see that through the videos, and I think they did the tortoise tour, and then all over the poster it was the tortoise emoji from your phone. They just have a bit of fun with it, and
they
sound
like they would be good live as well, these girls, right?
And exactly, and they've built up a big live following, doing quite big support slots this year in their own headline tours, and I just think it's kind of an exciting thing. Hopefully this album, which they've been working on with Catherine Marks, who's a rising super producer, she's a female producer, which you don't get that many female music producers, and she's been working with Wolf Alice and Foles, and she's developing a name for herself, and she did Cupid with them. And so I think the album's finished, and I'm guessing it's finished if it's coming out early next year. So I'll be interested to give it a listen, but hopefully it will be as good as everything they've put out so far.
It's going to be called Love in the Fourth Dimension. The band is Big Moon, as bigged up by Georgie Rogers. Your final choice, Georgie, is Ostra. Familiar probably to some listeners here. I think it's on our playlist. We certainly had them in for a session a couple of times. Talk us through what we might hear from future politics.
Yes, well, this one, I suppose it's kind of, if we're talking about, you know, going into next year and the end of last year and how things just seemed to unravel, didn't they, in 2016?
One of those albums that feels like suddenly they might want to put a question mark on the end of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this is the third album from the Toronto group, which is fronted by Canadian singer Katie Stillmanis. And the Utopia is the first taster of this album. Massive synths, an almost operatic vocal. And it's sort of calling, the whole album apparently is calling for radical hope. A commitment to replace the approaching dystopia, which surely, you know, is quite topical in this
we could all grim, use a bit of that.
grim, topsy-turvy world that we live in. It's a very positive message, actually, and positive feelings. And I feel like, you know, lyrically in this Utopia track, she says, I can picture a place where everybody feels it too. It might be fiction, but I see a place. There's nothing I wouldn't do. So it's kind of like she's not... trying to change the, she's putting ideas forward, but she's not necessarily, I think she knows the limitations of, you know, engagement rather than detachment, which is what she's trying to promote.
Okay.
And you know, she knows how to write a melody.
Should we see what Utopia sounds like? Here it goes. That is the sound of Utopia. It's new from Austria. It's going to be from an album called Future Politics, out on January the 20th, just a couple of weeks away. She can really sing, Katie Stelmanis. That's beautiful stuff.
Yeah, and it's sort of, it's accessible and it's sort of a punchy headphone moment of a track, I feel.
Yeah,
that.
We've all got our headphones on. We feel punchy.
I've only just picked myself off the floor.
I've never heard of it, and I'm looking forward to hearing more of it.
Yeah, she's a good guy. It's good stuff. It's cool. I think they record it in Montreal. They got really into sort of radical politics in the day, and then just went out, were partying all night. I think that's the one good antidote, right?
Her head in economical and philosophical texts apparently in the day, and then wild nights out. So
Keynes to ketamine in one fell swoop. Let's pretend I didn't say that and move swiftly on to books.
That's just your Christmas. Yes,
her lawyers are in touch even as we speak.
Well, it's been nice presenting this programme. Georgie Rogers, thank you very much indeed for your musical picks. It's time for books now. Mark Mason, what have you got up your sleeve? Something secretive first, I believe.
Something secretive. Oh, that's bad. I didn't know which one you wanted me to do. I know, so I'm
now
going to try
now
and...
You know.
No, now I know. Okay. Well, they're both sort of... No, there's no secrets in chess. The secretive one is a biography of a guy called Maxwell Knight. Been written by Henry Hemming, who himself sounds like a character from something.
Yeah.
Maxwell Knight used to be head of MI5, and I'd never heard of him. And he was known in the service as M. Now, the real head of the Secret Service is called C, and that comes from Maxwell Cumming, who was the first ever head of the Secret Service in Britain. And they took the C from Cumming, and that's why he's always been known as C. And Frederick Forsyth's theory of the James Bond books, in which the head of the Secret Service is known as M, coincidentally with this book, is that Ian Fleming took the M from Maxwell instead of the C from Cumming. And that's Forsyth's theory as to why Ian Fleming used M. But this was a real M. This guy really was head of MI5, not of MI6, called Maxwell Knight. And it's just one of those biographies.
So MI5 is the home service.
MI5 is the one that tries to stop us being spied on by other people, and MI6 goes around the world spying on the other people. And Maxwell Knight, we were saying in the programme before Christmas about things that you couldn't possibly believe are real being real. You know, truth being stranger than fiction. Maxwell Knight was a paradox, starts the blurb for this book, which is out in May. A jazz obsessive. You know, you put that in a novel, no one believed that the head of the Secret Service of MI5 was a jazz obsessive. And nature enthusiast, in brackets...
Naturist.
In brackets, he is the author of the definitive work on how to look after a gorilla. This wouldn't happen these days.
It was a different age, wasn't it?
You wouldn't get anywhere in any branch of the civil service, let alone the Secret Services.
A gorilla, G-U-E-R-I-L-A.
No, the G-O.
He should be good at that.
G-O, absolutely. No, the G-O. And so I just can't wait to find out more about this place. It's just one of those biographies that you think, I want to read about this because of brilliantly written blurb, but, you know...
That is sort of a bygone age of sort of colonial pets as well, right? Where, you know, like, the tiger's eating all the sandwiches again.
Yeah, well, I did the other week, just before Christmas, on Monocle, I was talking on the book programme about a book about London Zoo, and that London Zoo was started in the 19th century by a guy called Sir Stamford Raffles, he wasn't a spy, he was with the East India Company. Mm. And he just had a private collection of animals when he was out east with the East India Company. Got back, decided he wanted to do the same thing here. So while they were building London Zoo in Regent's Park, bang in the middle of Mayfair in Bruton Street, which coincidentally a few decades later the current Queen was born on, you know, one of the poshest parts of Mayfair with beautiful old townhouses, they stored some of the animals there while they were building the zoo. And the architect who was building the zoo buildings went into 33 Bruton Street one day and a monkey nicked his hat. It was, you're right, back then life was just
good
more
stuff.
Interesting.
It was.
wasn't James Bond the name. Wasn't he taken,
yeah. Oh,
taken from
good
a,
link.
A person who wrote a book on
oh,
birds?
Oh, look how his linky little mind works. Yeah, James.
This episode of QI is rather good, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? And a point for being so clever, Jason.
Oh, are you?
Field Guide to the Birds of the West Indies. Yes. It was written by a guy called James Bond. And Ian Fleming used to write the books out in the West Indies. He owned a,
yes, of course,
he owned
yeah.
a house out there even before he made his Bond millions. He was already pretty well off. And that's how he got the name, yeah.
We're going to talk about deep thinking next, where machine intelligence ends and human creativity begins. This is by former Grandmaster Garry Kasparov, no less.
Yes.
Now, this sounds like a fascinating idea.
Well, he's never spoken about it. Garry Kasparov, for those people who don't know, oh, this is where we feel old. Nearly 20 years ago. Well, 20 years ago this year, in the okay. early days of the new year. 20 years ago this year, he lost. Garry Kasparov, greatest chess player of his time, Grandmaster, world champion, whatever they call him. And he lost. He was the first chess player. Serious chess player ever to lose to a computer. It was called Deep Blue, and IBM had designed this computer just to play chess, and it finally managed to beat him. And he's never really spoken about it in depth. So you know, what more do you need for a sell on a book than that, just to find out how it did it? And I've sort of read little bits over the years in other chess experts analysing the games, and one of them, I'll be intrigued to see what Kasparov says about this. In one of them, the computer made a move that Kasparov thought, he credited the computer with too much intelligence. Basically, the computer had made a mistake and had got it wrong and did the move that you shouldn't do as the brilliant chess player. But Kasparov thought, well, it won't. It can't have made a stupid mistake like that. It must be looking forward. And he himself extrapolated 6 or 7 moves forward and thought, oh, that's why it's done it, because it's going to do X, Y, and Z in between. So because he credited it with too much intelligence, that affected the way he played. And so part of him being beaten was being beaten by the computer's stupidity, not by its intelligence. So it'll be intriguing to see how he reveals, you know, it's the big intellectual fascination of our times in how good is AI going to get? And there have been, you know, lots of films about this now. And also, I always think about it when, just to level up the music on the other side of the table. What was that song? Are We Human? Are We Dancer? Am I?
Yeah, The Killers.
The Killers. The Killers. Every time I hear the chorus of that, Are We Dancer? Are we human or Are We Dancer? And it's, you know, what it sheds light on our human brains, how good these computers are getting. That's the fascination of it.
I'm always wondering with Deep Blue, I've not seen a video of it playing chess.
No,
the IBM
I haven't.
Computer.
Actually, no.
Did it have arms and move the pieces, or was it like, did it kind of print out a little bit of paper and then a man would come around and move it for it? Because I think that would take away from, certainly if we were going to turn this into a film, that would be an amusingly crap part of the story.
Do you know what? I think it's more like HAL. HAL in 2001, which was which didn't have moving parts. It was just, that's what's scary about HAL is it's just that red light.
I know
for a fact that the computer, it wasn't a computer, it wasn't a robot. Mm.
I've seen a documentary about it and it isn't a robot.
So what was it? Was it a laptop? It was quite a
rudimentary kind of rubbish graphics machine. But it lit up the square where it would go.
Oh, did it? Yeah. Oh, right. And then someone moved the. So they were playing with a real chessboard.
They played with a real board.
Oh, didn't they?
No.
Ah.
Oh, right. Wow. It would flash up a thing.
Or they might have. Because I can't
remember. Jason Solomon would be drawn on it.
I remain quiet about these things. I'm not a grandmaster.
Now we're going to move on. This is a book that I reviewed just before Christmas. It's called The Bitmap Brothers Universe by Darren Wall and Duncan Harris. Now this is sort of following on from your one here, Mark. It's about the Bitmap Brothers were the people that did Gods, did Xenon, did Speedball, did all these kind of 8-bit computer games from the sort of early 90s. I had no patience for computer games. Neither was I allowed an NES. My parents would never buy me one. But later on, I sort of bought one for old time's sake. And this is the story of how computer programmers and game designers. It was kind of like punk in the late 70s. It was all people doing it on the cheap and with a lot of attitude and with kind of amazing sort of graphical and identity. And this book, we have to find out who the publishers are, because it's the most amazing book with the most amazing graphics, reproductions of these really, I suppose, old school, but you see the beauty in the pixel rather than the beauty in the perfection. Like kind of how Star Wars in 1977 was a bit more convincing than the prequels was. You got to see the models and all the rest of it. This is their story. And I never thought I would read a book about computer games and find it fascinating or beautiful. This is both of those.
I should look forward to that. You're making me think there of my 7-year-old son, who's still obsessed, less obsessed than he was a few months ago, but still obsessed with Minecraft.
Yeah.
And the big thing with Minecraft is it's really basic. It's just they've gone for it being a huge expanse that you can do lots of things on, but in relatively low-fi graphics, everything's cubic. But my son loves that, and he's used to seeing all the really whizzy stuff, you know, the equivalent of the new Star Wars films. He still likes the attraction of the old school stuff.
And does the book I mean, they almost seem anti-printed page and printed words. Such
yeah,
people.
Sort of
I mean, they're the sort of people why people don't read books is because they're always playing video.
But the thing is, they're kind of now out of it, and they're kind of looking back on their lives. They got out of it, sold out, and now I think they probably part funded this book in order to celebrate their former lives as software developers and game developers and stuff.
But you'd think they'd come up with a sort of ebook that's all kind of.
But I suppose that's part and parcel. Yeah, I think that's kind of telling that actually they wanted to do it as a really glorious hardback book that celebrates the kind of vision that they had on screen. Everyone probably derided them for being naff and or high tech and naff at the same time, whereas now it's just sort of beautiful. Mm. It's probably a collector's piece. It's the Bitmap Brothers Universe by Darren Wall and Duncan Harris. It's time for films, Jason Solomon. Do we have a clip from your first pick, which is La La Land, to get us in the mood?
She captured a feeling, sky with no ceiling, the sunset inside a frame. Here's to the ones who dream, foolish as they may seem. Here's to the hearts that ache. Here's to the mess we make.
Talking about going back to a more innocent age. La La Land, was that Emma Stone
singing?
That
was Emma Stone, yeah.
She stars with Ryan Gosling. They're good singers.
Well, I mean, yeah, they are, but they're not sort of trained singers, although, of course, Ryan Gosling was a Mouseketeer, same time as Britney and Christina Aguilera and Stop the Feeling, Justin Timberlake. Ooh! I can't say that without it. So he can do it, and he can dance and all of that stuff. Yeah. But the thing is about La La Land, which is why I'm going to talk about this, because it's going to dominate the first part of 2017, because it's going to dance all the way up to the Oscars. So we've got 2 months to talk about La La Land. And I can't wait. I'm delighted because I saw it in Venice in 2016, its world premiere. And I was like, oh my God, this is brilliant. I mean, it really is the antidote to what a crap year 2016 was and what a good liftoff 2017 is going to get, because we're all kind of celebrating this kind of escapist musical, which is nevertheless moving and sad. It's about he plays a jazz pianist who wants to open up a jazz club. She plays a wannabe actress who works in the coffee shop on the Warner Brothers lot. So it's an homage to LA, but it's about people who dream. Here's to the ones who dream, as we heard in her song there. And it's about the impossibility of these two having a relationship. I don't want to do a spoiler, but it's not a kind of happy ending in a way. But yet it's a film that kind of has you dancing on air and makes you want to cry and all of those things. It's terribly old-fashioned and yet feels immediately contemporary. It feels right now, and it manages to find a way to weave the dancing and the singing into the very fabric of our modern lives. And I think that's some achievement. Directed by Damien Chazelle, the music's fabulous. Those two, Warren Gosling and Emma Stone, I mean, they were in Crazy Stupid Love together and Gangster Squad less successfully, but you know, they're kind of adorable anyway. And then you think, oh, how they can't get any more adorable. Then you watch this film and you go, damn them, I love them both. People compare them to Astaire and Rogers. They're not as kind of honed and sharp and rehearsed as they are. They're a bit loosey-goosey about the whole thing, and it kind of, and that's what works. It makes it a bit more modern. They wear it lightly, even though they've clearly rehearsed kind of heavily. It's like, hey, look at me being a musical, because we can be musical in our current lives, and we are surrounded by music, but on our headphones, on our phones. It re-establishes that genre, I think, for a new generation. I dread to think we're going to get a load of rubbish musicals now because Hollywood jumps on a bandwagon.
I'm glad it's done it in a new way, because that's the horrible thing about the traditional old musical, is that you'll be going on, there'll be a nice little bit where two characters are interacting and there's an interesting story happening, and then you hear the pianist's right hand start to tinkle, and then one of them says, oh, and that reminds me of a song, and the first half of a sentence is spoken, then the second half they start singing, and you think, oh God, here we go.
This doesn't have the choppy editing of like that Baz Luhrmann tried to do it frenetically with Moulin Rouge. I mean, I like all that. I love the musical genre anyway, and I think it's part of cinema lore. I think it's very cinema. I think the musical is kind of one of the kind of key genres of it, because it's about dreaming and escape. But I think here, this is kind of on the Jacques Demy, you know, anyone who knows Demoiselle of Rochefort and the Umbrellas of Cherbourg. It has that speak sing in it, yet it has also some brilliant acting in it. I mean, I absolutely love La La Land. And I think it's one of those films that everyone's going to go and see with the hype because of the Oscar thing.
Yeah.
My heart kind of is relieved, because sometimes you say, oh, go and see that. And people go, oh, I think you can't go and see this. Even with all the hype, I think it withstands it and kind of stands up to it and will survive Oscar seasons.
Well, I love the fact that a musical and a traditional one, albeit not with an arched eyebrow, but with a wide embrace, can make a statement in 2017. We're back to something, possibly. Okay, A Sense for an ending. It sounds like on a very different note is your next choice, Jason. Talk us through this one. This was the Julian Barnes novel.
Yeah, I mean, now we're into territory. I haven't seen these films yet. These are forthcoming, yeah. So I don't know if it's going to be any good or not. I just know that I really enjoyed the Booker Prize-winning novel, yeah. Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes. I've always enjoyed Julian Barnes. And his authorial voice, I always felt, was very cinematic. Mm. And yet people have struggled to make his books into anything, sort of anything other than sort of posh telly. I remember Metroland as well. It was all right, but it wasn't great. So I hope Sense of Ending has got a cinematic kind of feel to it. It's been directed by Ritesh Batra, who's an Indian filmmaker. So you think, well, this is a very English story. Why is this kind of Indian filmmaker? He did the film called The Lunchbox, which was a rather beautiful film, yeah. About the sort of Mumbai lunchbox system and two people getting crosswise.
Yeah.
It was rather lovely. So he's dealing with this, and it's got the most British cast, like Harriet Walter and Emily Mortimer and Jim Broadbent and Michelle Dockery. And I think that it's going to be very much about, it's about sending your past and putting things together and trying to kind of make sense of the past and choices and destiny and you know the turning of turning on a sixpence, I suppose. So I think it's ripe for cinematic inclusion.
You're always struggling with a book, aren't you? Because, you know, a book has got 300, 400 pages to do, much more than you can do in 90 minutes. And you always, if you've read the book, you will always go,
I've already seen it in my head.
And also, they've missed that bit. They didn't quite get that subtlety. Yeah. They've lost that character completely. So you're always struggling. So, yeah.
I'm quite happy to jettison those composite characters, which often they do. They say, this one represents three characters. But the book was very sparse. It wasn't overpopulated. So I felt it was ripe for it. In fact, it probably needed a bit of boosting. So, and I've also now forgotten a bit of the book. So I'm not a stickler for it. It's just, can they capture the tone of it? And yeah. That's what filmmakers kind of often struggle. Gillian Barnes has got a very singular tone. Ritesh Batra is going to bring his stuff to it. The person who did the screenplay is as well. So I have a sense of trepidation about A Sense of an Ending.
Well, I suppose there are many, many short stories that made into movies rather than long novels.
Novellas are brilliant.
And A Sense of an Ending was almost a novella.
It was very
only
small.
130 pages. Or something.
Exactly.
It's quite a short book. So, well, we pin our hopes on A Sense of an Ending. We're going to talk briefly at the end, Jason, about the world in Blockbuster's Wonder Woman Chips. I can't believe it. I love it, actually. I was going to say Murder on the Orient Express. Why don't we tackle all three of those bits? Let's start with Wonder Woman. I love the trailer.
Yeah, I mean, Wonder Woman is Wonder Woman. Great. We've seen her a bit, actually, because she started out in all these Marvel films. They all kind of come, you know, they meld into one and they kind of end up putting Spider-Man into the Captain America movie. You go to Captain America and it's like, well, he's not even in it. It's like it's all Iron Man and Wonder Woman trying to make it. She was in Batman, Superman. She's not Marvel, she's DC. I know people are going to ring in and say, Jason, you don't know your comic books. I don't know my comic books. All right. I know these movies of them and they're generally rubbish, to be honest with you, and empty. I'm really hoping that Wonder Woman kind of gives it some balls because they are so anodyne and kind of, they operate in such a kind of vacuum of anything like sense or normalcy. So I'm hoping that a really empowered female superheroine will do something for the genre. She's been played by Gal Gadot, who's an Israeli supermodel-y type person. Yeah. Although I'd never heard of her.
That's interesting, because you know she lost her UN ambassador role just before Christmas.
Why?
They appointed Wonder Woman as a UN ambassador for equality for women around the world. In October last year, and then in December they took it away because there had been protests, because I think the quote from the UN was something like, in her current iteration, basically, if you're our age, Linda Carter, she is a white woman with she's a large-breasted white woman with an impossible figure. So that's why she was, so it'll be interesting to see in the new guys.
She's not anything. She is a white woman.
Right.
Might be Jewish, which I don't know if that counts. And she looks a bit skinny, I was a bit like...
Her get the UN job back then, if the new iteration,
I mean, she's directed by Patty Jenkins, who's a woman as well, so it's good to have her.
I thought there's going to be some good feminist kick-ass fun here.
I'm really hoping there is. My fear is that there won't be, and it'll just be rubbish again.
All right, okay. Chips. I think we've got time just
chips.
For a very small portion.
I'm just
of chips.
Saying chips because I remember watching Chips almost after Wonder Woman on the telly in the 70s. Poncherella and Eric Estrada and John Baker. Mm. So I mean, I'm sure it's going to be absolutely stupid as all these things are, but it's Chips, California Highway Patrol.
We can handle
with Michael Peña as Eric Estrada's Poncherella. Michael Peña is great, and Poncherella's cool. So I'm sure it'll be really unfun. funny. But it's just all of those Starsky and Hutch things. They're not great, are they? And this is going to be subgenre. But I should tell you that Chips is coming back.
Guffaws happen as we even listen to the idea that Chips is coming back. Jason Solomon, thank you very much for leading us a merry dance, mostly through La La Land and a bit of a sense of an ending too. Mark Mason, thank you very much indeed for telling us about your pick of the beginning of the year in books. And Georgie Rogers, thank you very much for your musical picks as well. That brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture. My producer was Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.